The Why Me Project, an exclusive presentation of Faith Strong Today.
Episode number
145.
145. Mm-hmm. Keeping it alive.
We are.
Thank you to everyone who has reached out. And we say this every week, mm-hmm. but whether you're on our Insta, on our Facebook, on the Twitter, you can email us. For those who have, we're very appreciative.
Because we've had the opportunity to reach out to some amazing guests and been really inspired and encouraged by their stories.
Like our guest this week, and Amy Herrig. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I would say that we're good, but you get to live in, from what some people have told me, is God's country and Dallas, Texas. So we like to ask this skill testing question because we never know where it's going to go. Amy, who are you and where did you come from?
Where did I come from? That's a good one. You know, I'm a mother, wife, business owner. I'm lucky to say I think I'm a friend to many, and I have a lot of wonderful friends. I was born in Texas in 1975 in Dallas to wonderful parents who embraced the hippie culture of life at that time and gave me a wonderful, wonderful childhood filled with lots of love and attention and really anything and everything a child could want. They did run kind of a counterculture business at the time, so that made life a little untraditional, I guess, but wonderful life, wonderful childhood, great parents, can't say enough about that, and I've just kind of always been here in Texas, except for our travels as I got older and we opened businesses in other places, but Texas is where I call home.
Okay, so I'm assuming, and I'll just make this as a guess, being from Texas, love football?
Love the Dallas Cowboys. Yep. So it was a heartbreaker year this year, but that's okay. We've got next year.
There's always next year.
Yes.
There's always next year. But yeah, we're a big football family. We certainly are.
It seems like everything for you is pretty good.
Yeah, everything is good. I was a good student. We moved outside of Dallas when I was in third grade to a smaller town, a rural community. That was a bit of an adjustment at first, but I assimilated and in band. And the nice thing about a small school is you can be involved in a lot of things. I was a cheerleader and in band and in athletics. And so at our football games in high school, you'd see people in the marching band out there in their football uniform and cheerleading outfit. So it was great.
So if you're heavily involved in schooling stuff and cheerleading and athletics and band, my assumption is then as you go through childhood into your teen years, then everything is perfect and you don't have to worry about anything.
Yeah, I mean, as I got a little older in high school, I probably dipped my toes in things that, kids do but shouldn't. And, I had a good time and didn't always make the right choices and probably wasn't always the nicest person, as sometimes teenage girls aren't. But I had a great childhood. Things were good.
So growing up in that kind of day and age, if someone was to say, Amy, what do you want to be when you grow up? Was it always a business focus or was it something else?
You know, I think in the back of my mind, I thought I would maybe do something with my parents one day because I am an only child. But it wasn't like at the top of my goals of what I was going to do when I graduated high school. It was just sort of this thing that was out there that maybe I'd become part of one day. But I wanted to be a journalist, an attorney. I had all sorts of kind of ideas. I always loved to write a lot. So, something that could incorporate that was always at the top of my list.
At what point do you think, looking back on, where you are now to growing up, at what point in your life would you want to make a change? Do you think that you'd want to do something different?
My honest answer to that, as a, 40, almost 45-year-old woman who has reflected back and learned a lot from everything I've gone through, is I guess nothing, because I like where I've evolved to today. That's because I've looked back and looked at what I could do differently and how I could use some really bad choices and decisions to do things differently. There's definitely defining moments in my life where I made some decisions that were clearly not the right decision at that time, or they were just really poor choices that led to some real negative circumstances in my life. Towards the middle end of my senior year, I deviated off any sort of positive track I had in life and went into a downward spiral. My parents divorced, and I just did not handle it well at all. And it led to me and getting involved in a very negative, abusive relationship that was filled with a lot of drugs and a boyfriend that, to this day, we refer to as the bad news boyfriend, and led to a very serious heroin addiction. So, you know, that was definitely a turning point in my life that was defining and not in the best way. Ultimately, many years later, I've learned to talk about it and use it into making it something positive, but definitely a turning point in my life then.
It's so interesting because you hear some people say, well, when your parents divorce when they're younger, when you're younger, it's so much harder on the individual because they have so much more time to only have mom and or dad. But then you hear of these stories about when, you know, teens are getting older and their parents divorce, that it plays a pivotal role in their life.
It was a very pivotal role in my life. And I know it's something still sometimes that I think my parents feel badly about. You know, you don't like to watch your child hurt or suffer. And I don't hold them accountable for that at all. As an adult now, I just understand that sometimes things, you know, they just aren't working out for whatever reason. And, you know, really, truthfully, with the strong foundation I had and all the love I had from my parents, I could have and should have handled it differently. I think for me, it was just a perfect storm going on in my life at that time. I was graduating high school. I was already starting to experiment in negative behaviors and do things that, you know, weren't good choices. And then this boyfriend came along who was more than happy to help me drown my sorrows and whatever was available. So it just was a really bad combination of a lot of things happening at once. But I got divorced when my kids were three. I have twins. And, you know, of course, I struggled with how that would affect them long term and what impact that could have on their ideas of marriage and family and how their dad and I would get along. And I'd like to say that we've done a beautiful job. I will say I'll pat myself and him on the back of co-parenting. And I had a therapist tell me at that time, you know, if you're going to do this, it's really, there's no great age, but it's really probably the best age, because particularly if the parents have a strong friendship and ability to co-parent together. Granted, my kids don't have memories of their parents being together, and they don't know what that's really like, but they've had a lot of love and support by two households in their life and a lot of consistency, believe it or not. So, yeah, I think there's never a great time. And I think it's just how the parents handle it and how each individual child responds. I don't think there's a perfect age to put on it.
I'm naive in the sense that when it comes to drugs and drug usage and that, I've never dabbled. I say that as a negative, but I mean, I'm looking at it.
No, I understand. Yeah.
Right? But I'm assuming that you knew it was wrong. How does someone then get involved in that?
Clearly, I knew it was wrong. I didn't just, you know, right out of the gate go from never putting a drug in my body in my life to shooting up heroin. It was a, you know, sort of progression and a lot of experimenting and engaging in different behaviors and, oh, I'll do this drug for a while and then this drug. And really, none of the drugs, there's a term in the world of addiction called the drug of choice, and none of them really became my drug of choice. I didn't really, I would always, okay, that's getting boring, let's go on to something else. And then, you know, heroin, if anyone does that more than once, you're physically addicted. I mean, it's so addicting to the body. So even if you didn't love it, you're going to have these immediate withdrawals that are really awful. So the addiction sets in pretty quickly. But clearly, someone who even engages in that is not in a good place in their life. It's pretty much playing Russian roulette with your life. Anyone knows that's potentially a death sentence. And so it wasn't by the time I got to that point of engaging in heroin use, it wasn't even my parents' divorce anymore. It was that I was in this negative relationship. I wasn't doing anything productive with my life. All my friends from high school were going to college and doing, not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them, and doing, you know, good things and moving forward. So I, you know, I just didn't like myself at all. And I didn't see any real positivity in my world and didn't know how to get back on that positive track.
What was instrumental in your life to get you off of that trajectory into the one that you found yourself later on?
Well, my boyfriend was arrested, so that was very helpful.
So that helps, yeah.
Yeah, that
helped. I mean, it was really a gift from God. I mean, I knew I was in a bad place. I would go to work every day. I don't really know how I managed to keep a job, and who knows how long that would have continued. But and I was a receptionist, an admin assistant, and sit at my desk. I'd have withdrawals by the afternoon every day. I mean, I couldn't even make it through a whole day without having withdrawals set in. And I knew I wanted to change. I knew it wasn't, you know, I didn't want to keep using, but I just couldn't stop. And I didn't know how to ask anyone for help. I had, you know, pushed everyone that was good in my life away. I barely had a relationship with my parents at that point. He got arrested, yanked out of my life. My family was very supportive and helped me get back to health and go through recovery. I don't want to say that was the easy part. I mean, kicking a physical addiction is not easy, but it's certainly a lot easier if you have a lot of love and support and people cheering you on and holding your hand. And I didn't go into like an inpatient rehab, but I started counseling right away. And I went to my mother's rehab. I jokingly say that, but my mom and stepdad took me in, and they just helped me through every step of the way. After I went through the physical withdrawals and kicked the habit, so to speak, for the first time in years, I had all these emotions and thoughts that I was feeling and thinking about because I'd been numbed out for so long. So then that was kind of the harder part, because then I suddenly had to deal with all these feelings of anger and bitterness. That was a whole nother step. And I think that's unfortunately where a lot of people get stuck in their recovery. They, you know, vow to sobriety, they're going to quit, I'm not going to use anymore. And then they're sober and they have to deal with emotions and thoughts that they haven't dealt with in a long time. And that's why they used in the first place.
How much did faith and your faith play a role in moving to that next level?
It played a huge part. I had been raised with general Christian beliefs. I say it that way because with my parents being hippies and embracing that lifestyle, organized religion was not part of my upbringing. In fact, they were kind of anti-organized religion, but not ever anti-God. We talked about God and spirituality a lot. I never had a disbelief or doubted that God existed and was, you know, part of our lives. But when I went and moved in with my mom and stepdad after and went through this recovery period, ironically, both my parents had started with their new spouses going to the same church, not the same church, but I'm sorry, the same religion, Methodist church, two different churches. But so that was kind of so I started going with them a lot, and it was a really cool experience. I got baptized at 21 on my own decision, which I was very meaningful. And it just, I understood that I had gone through something and survived something that a lot of people didn't, and that I was really lucky to be alive, and that there must be some reason for that, and that, you know, God must have some purpose for me to still be on this earth. The problem was, though, I was still relatively young and immature in some ways, especially when you've done drugs for that many years, it kind of stifles your growth. So there was a lot of catching up for me to do. And I just, faith was important, and I definitely tapped into my faith greater, but I still at that point didn't fully understand about grace and letting go of shame and using our negatives into something positive and even help others. Instead, I kind of carried the shame and guilt around for years about this heroin addiction and the things I had done, because I didn't really still know how to process it. I'd stopped the drug addiction, but I still hadn't learned to not be addicted to negative thoughts and behaviors.
No longer using drugs, you're mending relationships. Life then seems to be easy and back on track, and you've never had to deal with another issue after that.
Well, that's how it would seem. There were these wonderful years where everything did seem to be moving along. I got married, although it did end in a divorce. It was a very amicable divorce. I had the best blessings of my life come out of that marriage, my twins. And through that marriage and a lot of counseling as a result of that marriage, I did do a lot of inner growth and discovered that I was a stronger person than I thought, and really learned a lot about what I really wanted in life. I probably kind of rushed into that first marriage because I was so still to this recovery period of my life and just trying to move on. And he was a great guy, and we were great friends. And, you know, I'll get married and I'll have kids and I'll do all this stuff. And yes, life will be wonderful and I'll be doing what everyone else is doing and I don't have to think about all this shameful behavior I did in the past. In fact, I don't even have to tell people about it, except when I would be at functions and social circles and people would talk about their college years and things they were doing back then. And it was like really uncomfortable for me because I knew what I was doing during those years. And instead of just saying, hey, I did this and look, I recovered through it and that takes a lot of strength to do that, and I want to help other people. I just lived with the shame of it. But through all that, also met the absolute love of my life, the most wonderful man I've ever known, and things were wonderful, and we had, you know, everything in life one could want. And he's a remarkable stepdad to my kids. And, yeah, things were moving along greatly, except that in my effort to feel that I was worthy and part of the society that I live here in Dallas, Texas, where often money can define people, or at least we think it does. I had gone to work with my father in our family businesses and engaged in practices that made us a lot of money, and albeit they weren't really illegal, as we were ultimately accused of them being, but definitely some immoral choices. Mm. That led to a lot of problems.
When it came to going into business with your dad, did you feel like there wouldn't be that sort of thing, or did it just kind of evolve almost naturally that activity started to happen?
It really evolved naturally. You know, as I mentioned earlier, my parents were in this counterculture industry. It's not really considered as counterculture anymore. We own retail stores that a lot of people would call head shops, smoke shops that sell pipes and smoking accessories and things of that nature. And so when I was a young child, there were issues with that, particularly in the early 80s with the conservative Reagan errors and the Just Say No campaigns. But a lot of that has subsided. And, you know, it's obviously a very different culture now, and society views that as a whole, I think, really differently. And also, by the time I went to work with my father, we had other businesses. He had diversified a lot. So, no, I thought it was a okay thing for me to go into business with him. And it was. There were some products that became very prevalent in our industry, and actually being sold online and in gas stations and everywhere. And so we began selling them just like everyone else. And I don't mean that flippant, because just because someone else is doing something doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. But
sure,
it was a business decision to stay competitive with what we saw going on in our industry. And we, you know, ended up becoming sort of not the leaders of it, but selling a lot more of it than anyone else. And really, I guess, drawing some negative attention to ourselves. And it led to a lot of legal problems. That's probably putting it mildly, but yes, big legal problems.
Do you think the book is available now, No More Dodging Bullets, a memoir about faith, love, lessons, and growth? Do you think you having to write the book was that therapeutic way for you to process everything?
Absolutely. I wrote the first draft of my story, my memoir, about 2 years into about a year and a half into the legal situation. I had a lot of time on my hands due to having to be at home because of the restrictions that were put on us while we were working through this and waiting for trial. My first draft of this was sort of just this emotional purge of my entire life that I was not really intended for anyone to read, but it was very therapeutic for me to get it all out there. And then I did a lot of journaling after that as time went on and I was going through different things. And yeah, it was like a roadmap of my life. And it was really clear then to see, well, this happened. And then that caused me to make this decision and then that decision. And, you know, for example, I knew that I'd always carried around the shame and kept these teenage years and my drug addiction from way back then a secret from people, but I had never really sat down and analyzed how that impacted so many of my decisions later and how the insecurities that I carried around because of that time led to me wanting to make decisions based on greed and money and thinking that would somehow define me and make me worthy in a society that often defines people by that. And so, yeah, it was very therapeutic.
as you, you know, went through your book, I mean, there's been so many more other challenges just beyond this, health challenges as well, and just being able to reflect and process on this life journey. What was one of those just main lessons that you're able to take out of where you've been to where you are now?
I think the biggest lesson I've been able to take out of it is we have to learn to forgive ourselves and not carry around shame and guilt. And we have to learn to live with grace. And that's a symbiotic thing. We have to have it for ourselves and be able to give it to other people. And I didn't really understand what grace meant. You know, we hear that term, but I didn't really know how that could work in my life, and really how I could also, not only could it work for me, and that, you know, my faith, our faith teaches us that it's there if we want for it and we ask God for forgiveness and we work towards doing better, all of that's possible. But I could also then give it to others. I was awfully judgmental at times in my life, and I think we do that as a result of our own shame and our own insecurities. We project them on the other people. So I think grace is probably the biggest lesson I've learned, giving it and receiving it.
And what about any why me moments? Can you think of any, whether it was in a valley or a mountaintop?
Yes, and I love that term, valley and mountaintop. My kids and I, at night at dinner, usually say, what was your mountain and valley of the day today? So I love that analogy. You know, I mean, there were several of those. Definitely when the legal proceedings started, there was this why me, because, as I'd said earlier, we weren't the only people engaged in this business practice. And, you know, why is this happening to us? Why aren't they doing it to other people? But then it was like, okay, well, it is happening. So what am I going to learn from it? And what am I going to do? And I think anytime someone gets diagnosed with cancer, which also happened to me in the course of this 4-year legal battle, there is a little bit of a why me. But I think really quickly, too, I think there's this opposite reaction that we can and should have, that is, why not me? I actually heard years ago, and I'm not saying I'm a fan of hers or not, I don't want to get political, but Sarah Palin, I remember her saying years ago in an interview when she was running or whatever, that when they found out her youngest was, when she was pregnant and then he had Down syndrome, that her first reaction was, why me? And her husband said, well, why not us? And I thought that was a very important thing to hear. And it lasted with me forever. Why not me? I mean, what makes one of us, why should I be immune from something and someone else shouldn't? So I try and live with that philosophy. Well, why not me?
You've gone through this life, and you've had your ups and your downs, your why me moments, as you had mentioned. There's also an opportunity sometimes when we have clarity and there's a chance for us to give back. Let's talk about, what is Hopeful Tuesdays?
Hopeful Tuesdays is next to my kids and my marriage and my family and work, it's my pride and joy. And I don't mean pride in a narcissistic way. It's just something that I'm just so proud to be a part of. As I said earlier, was awfully judgmental at times, and I would never give money to homeless people if I saw them. And, you know, I never even made the effort to have, like, people call them, like, little homeless care packages or bags that they carry in their car. I mean, I just had this unfortunate mindset that, you know, there's shelters, there's places they can go, there's, you know, I pay my tax dollars, certainly they're being used somehow to help them. It was a really not nice outlook to have. And after everything had been taken from us and seized, as I was evolving through that process, and so many people helped us and supported us and gave us grace and helped us even financially and in every way possible, I, you know, it opened my eyes to that we all struggle and we all have a story and we all have done something that, you know, even if we've grown and it's turned into a positive, we wished we hadn't done or that we could have done differently. And so I started actually on a trip to Philadelphia with my husband during that time, a work trip we went on. We befriended a homeless gentleman that were talking to on the street, and ultimately ended up getting him pants and shoes, and he got a job, and it was just this really great story. And so it changed my perspective greatly, and I started interacting here and there with some of the homeless neighbors in our area where we have our office and warehouse building, and it led to me inviting them, one of them, to come have lunch one day in our break room with us, where we all sit down and eat together at work. And also because I said he could take a shower. We have a shower facility here in the building. And so he did, and I encouraged him to bring some friends the next day, and he did. And that was a Tuesday. And so we started doing that every Tuesday. Eventually the group grew though to 20 to 30 people. So we extended it to Fridays, and then that grew. And so, now we serve lunch, Tuesday through Friday, in a back room of our building that we converted, and they get showers. We help them with their laundry. We have partnered with larger resources that come and help them if they're interested looking into housing opportunities, getting their IDs back, because that's a big thing for a lot of them, as they've lost all of that. They may want to integrate back into society, but or at least what we consider society. They have their own society. It's very interesting. But, so it's just been a lot of people refer to it as a ministry, which I kind of struggled with that for a while because I felt like that was so daunting. Who am I to start a ministry? But that is what it is. And it's just a beautiful thing. In fact, as soon as we get off this interview, I'll run back there. I saw them coming in right before I got on the phone with you guys. And it just brings so much joy to my life, because I know they would say that I'm helping them, but they help me because I see their strength and I see their resilience and I see their vulnerability and I see their faith. Maybe they're living a life that is what many of us would consider not desirable, but it's a hard life and it takes a lot to make it through that life day to day. And so they inspire me, which is a thing I never thought I would say about interacting with the homeless, but it's just been a wonderful thing.
No More Dodging Bullets is available now. You can jump online to hopefultuesdays.org or amyherrig.com. Amy, we appreciate you. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Big thanks again to Amy Herrig for taking some time, and just an incredible story with an amazing journey.
Emphasis on incredible. Definitely check out her book. I can't even imagine that she went through all of that.
Thank you again to everybody who continually reaches out. And again, if there is somebody that you think that we should have on the podcast, our favorite thing is trying to track them down and convince them to spend some time with us.
It's like we're detectives who are trying to, I don't know.
Reminder to find us on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, on Pinterest, on MySpace,
okay,
on Pure Volume,
okay.
And you can also Ask Jeeves, Google, and or Yahoo.
Or just some of those, but for sure, you can head to faithstrongtoday.com.